And we're live with episode 315. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi. And Seth Law. Sorry, I can't think today, Seth. I'm all over the place.
It is fine. And welcome back to another episode. There are a few things that I wanted to talk about. I mean, this is number 315. First up is, as usual, I do want to talk about training for just a minute because both courses are selling and seem to be selling out rather quickly. So we've got Harnessing LLMs for Application Security that we're going to be offering at OMA at KernelCon, first of all. That one is a great place to actually get your feet wet, and it's a great price. We're supporting the conference there by bringing Harnessing LLMs along for the ride. And there's going to be so many updates. Ken and I have already been talking about skills and agents and updated exercises for this course because it's just changing so much. Probably even some OpenClaw and some Claude Code, Codex, other things that are a little bit higher level than just like the LangChain Python scripting that we've done in the past, but that are we're using on a daily basis now. And anybody that's in code on a daily basis is probably already using Claude Code, is probably already using Copilot. So being able to utilize those tools effectively in an AppSec pipeline is exactly what we're trying to get to. And this also goes back to a conversation that Ken and I were having prior to coming live on the podcast, and maybe we should be doing some of that live, but we're not. But around just the, I want to say like naivete of a lot of AppSec tools and code scanning tools that are coming out on a day-to-day basis, right? I don't know what you want to talk about there, Ken. But it's an interesting thing to actually go look at the prompts that are being used in a lot of these open source projects, right? It's one of the first things that I do, having taught like how to do prompt engineering. When we talk about LLMs, how to structure prompts and how to like use things like RICE and like the different prompt engineering frameworks, it does feel like a lot of, I don't want to say this. A lot of prompts are being built by Claude Code and not necessarily crafted by individuals. So things get nuked pretty quickly, right? They may have started out with, hey, you're an expert security, code reviewer or whatever it is. And then they start to come up with edge cases. They have Claude Code regenerate things or Codex regenerate things. And sometimes it's effective, sometimes it's not. But I'm seeing quite a bit of that. Where the prompts aren't necessarily designed by an individual, you can tell that they've been built by Claude. And it's not necessarily a bad thing because you do accomplish what you want to, but the nuances we're starting to lose in that prompt engineering role, I want to say. And anyway, so if you want to get into all of that, that's what this course is for. KernelCon is your first opportunity. And then we are going back to Southeast Asia, B-Sides Singapore, DEF CON Singapore. Apparently B-Sides is on my brain. DEF CON Singapore. We will be there. Looking forward to both of those opportunities. Anything else you want to mention on those before we launch into topics today?
No, but I mean, KernelCon is really, it's about like a month away. So it's like, if you're going to that, like you should definitely sign up now. Probably be the only thing I would add because we're getting down to the wire there. We'll promote it some more online as well. But yeah, I don't know what else to talk about. I mean, I think like one interesting thing that's changed is that with that specific type of, not just our course, but just type of course, is that like when we first started teaching people this I think it was like KernelCon actually was our first in-person version of this. I'm not sure. It's been like two, three years ago. I'm not sure. And now, but at that time, if you wanted to actually do anything, like you had to like with AI, you had to build your own tooling with like a library or just with raw prompt calls or whatever. And then all the orchestration was on you. And there's a lot to do there. yeah, now it's like, you only really need to know that if you're building production systems. If you're just running Claude on your machine to like do some security work or whatever, it's like, man, you get so much for free now. It's just ridiculous. Really just pay for the model cost and all the orchestration gets done locally on your machine for you. And like you said, you can use skills and prompts and things like that to really skills, which are basically an extension of prompts, if you ask me.
Yeah,
to do that. So I don't know. It seems easier than ever to work with those tools locally, at least. It's a different thing to build a production system, obviously, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, and that's kind of what we're addressing with some of these updates is, okay, a single use practitioner versus building a prod system or a pipeline that you could actually use in your CI/CD pipeline is two different things, right? It's not always apparent when we first start using these tools, since, you know, it feels like magic that first, you know, couple times that you get Claude to identify a vulnerability or you're using Copilot or whatever it is. But the whole fact that it's a non-deterministic and a creative tool means that the results may not be the same time and time again. So how do you make sure that you're getting full coverage? How do you actually like get reliable results every time that you scan a repository or you're interacting with an application? How do you make sure to mix determinism in with a creative tool? That's the trick. And that's what is so difficult from an engineering perspective, because you can't depend on the LLM to come back with the same result 100% of the time, nor should you expect it to come back with that same result. And so it's this like, how do you get from it's a magic tool to crap, it's not giving me everything I need, to this is now something reliable that I can hand to my developers and they're not going to, you know, they're not going to come at me with pitchforks when they realize that we missed a vulnerability and all of a sudden we failed some SOC audit or we got exploited unintentionally, right? But because we did not actually analyze things properly. So come and let's talk about it, because it's what Ken and I have been dealing with for the past 2 years on the LLM side of things.
Yeah, I shared this. I did share this to, on this note, I did share this on LinkedIn, but let me put it in here. I think it was from one of the Project Discovery people, actually. They put out a graphic. I'm sure you saw it. And let me put it in Slack too here. Yep, there we go. You can see, and here, let me pull it up too. I guess it's probably another thing I should do is actually pull up the infographic. But I think this, like, share this here, share screen, yeah. That right there.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd seen this, but yeah, this was from Kevin Jay, principal security consultant at Baldur's Security. In any case, it was let's actually see how it does what it's doing when it use it, like when Claude's code. Can't talk today, man. My brain is just like fried. Security review with Claude code against 50 different iterations. This is the output. This is sort of what you see. And then there's this drop off, right? And it really illustrates like what I try to tell people, which is like, yes, this is what you deal with. This is the outcome. Mm-hmm. Like yep. Your whole life will be spent making that look more deterministic. Like that, like that's it. That's what you're going to do. You're going to spend all your time doing that. So anyways, like I thought it was just a really nice illustration of the reality of working with these things. Never have I seen anything.
It really is, right? Like, cause the more that you deal with like identifying those vulnerabilities and even something that is a positive deterministic signal coming out of code can be interpreted multiple ways by the AI. And depending on its focus, depending on how you've written that prompt, depending on I don't know, like how much coffee it had that morning, I guess, it can mark that positive or negative, and you've got to account for it. So, yeah, I mean, I know you've seen the same thing because, you know, I like the tools as we've built them against vulnerable, like intentionally vulnerable applications. I'm always fascinated to see what it identifies, what it doesn't, what the gaps are, and how it reliably, like, almost misses things, right? Like where its focus is attention. It's a fascinating like engineering problem, but it's also stressful, right? So yeah,
it is. I did want to tell you about something very, very cool, and I know we're not the only ones. Meaning, like, When I say not the only ones, I mean like there's like non-security tools, functional tools that allow you to interact with them this way. But like one thing I'm really excited about is we just put in this ability to do like pull request feedback. So like when you get a finding, you can actually basically have a like a debate if you wanted to, but you can say like, hey, I think this is a false positive, or I think this is a nitpick, and get your thing like unblocked, whatever pull request you're at. And like, I'm only bringing that up because that's like another, that's the next level of where I see everything sort of going, right? Which is like, forget ASPMs, forget bug tickets. We're now moving into a world with AI code reviewers where you can talk to them, you can get to resolution, you can get past things. You don't have to go talk to security all the time. You don't have to file bug tickets all the time. So I'm saying that to say like, yes, these things are really a painful. Yes, they're really takes more work than anybody really understands at scale and in production land. But my God, is it unlocking new ways of working where AppSec doesn't have to be this big blocker, doesn't have to be this huge gate, doesn't have to be this big process, but can keep governance, can keep observability, can keep things secure. So it's just, it's like, I will not keep doing this forever, but I just keep going on about this because I'm like, dude, this is a new world and I'm so excited for it. And I'm happy about AppSec again. And it's got me like motivated. So,
yeah, cool. Well, good. I only meant to spend a couple minutes on that, but it is the reality of our lives right now. So worth it to talk for a little bit. The first article that I actually wanted to talk about today was one that Talos brought up in Slack. And there was a little bit of discussion about it, but recently Truffle Security, the guys that do Truffle Hog, I'm going to post it in.
yeah, I remember seeing this.
LinkedIn here.
Yeah.
Basically came out and they were doing analysis on Google API keys, right? Google API keys for a number of years. Yes, there's like ones that you want to keep secret, but you can assign permissions to keys basically. And people have been using them for years to embed maps on pages, right? Like, oh, this is where we're at. We're going to embed the little map link on our storefront page so people can click on it. It opens Google Maps. And yeah, we get charged a little bit for including it there, right? But that's all that those Google API keys were used for, was to be able to embed those maps and to show specific values. And I've had discussions with developers and clients for years about those Google API keys, just to make sure that there wasn't anything there outside of, yeah, you could run up Maps credit, but realistically, no one's really going after those. However, Google has changed the rules. For whatever reason, by default, they enabled Gemini access for all keys that had been issued. At least that's what it looks like, including all of these Google Maps keys that developers have used for years and years to interact with Google Maps. So Truffle Security did some research, realized that when Gemini access was enabled for an organization, these Maps keys got permissions to actually access Gemini as well, which means you can go pick off that Google API key from someone's public website, which is being exposed via JavaScript in order to embed the map, and use that to interact with Gemini. This is going to be a huge problem for a lot of organizations, and it's going to induce additional cost. I mean, honestly, with something like OpenClaw out there nowadays that could go just pick up those keys and try to use them, I would be surprised if this is not being exploited in the wild right now, now that it's actually come out. I don't know if what Google's response to this has been yet, right? And I would be interested to see how the scope defaults have changed or what people could actually do. Yeah, but there really just hasn't been that much activity around it since it came out yet. And it almost like it's just kind of disappeared into the wind, even though it's a huge cost problem that could actually exist. And this kind of goes back to observability of your platform and knowing what your credentials are that are actually being used on a day-to-day basis, right? If you understand what your attack surface looks like and what credentials are actually being used and how your application is functioning, it's going to be a lot easier to know whether or not you are exposed in this manner. However, if developers are just willy-nilly able to deploy things, there's no gates, you don't have something that's actually digging through your code for these sorts of results, or you've suppressed it because it happened to be a Google Map key, you're going to have to revisit that, and it may end up costing you and your organization money. Yeah, that's my soapbox on that one, Ken. I don't know like what you would consider there or what your thoughts are.
Oh, yeah. My takeaway is a little different. Well, just because, yeah, I mean, I agree. But I also think like this is the cost right now of, okay, so they mentioned in the article how like Google's got a very complex ecosystem. It's very hard to ship software with that complexity and not make a mistake. And of course, with these systems being newer, yeah, that totally tracks. That totally, totally makes sense. But I think it, and I'm not saying that's the root cause, but it does bring to mind sort of this problem that's been in my head, which is just this arms race that every software development group is in, every organization is in right now. It's like all of a sudden you have this superpower to ship software and just ship software, right? That doesn't mean you can ship resilient software. That doesn't mean you can ship software that was designed well. That doesn't mean you're shipping secure software. It just means that you can ship software really, really quickly. There are guardrails, skills, superpowers, things like that to obviously influence. And there's reviewers that you can have. And the more bots, I always say the more bots, the better reviewing your code and all that fun stuff. But at the end of the day, you're just shipping software. So why am I saying that? I'm saying that because with this like arms race to build as fast as the next person and keep up with the Joneses, I fear that that in the short term, the players who are incentivized to be fast and loose are going to be fast and loose. And they may initially win in whatever their business line or their line of business is, get customer adoption and all that, with those dark, ugly corners right around, you know, or I should say those dark edges or those problems are just sort of waiting for you, you know? And so why I'm saying that is like, imagine a company that sort of gets a bunch of adoption and then in a year or two, start having a lot of outages, start having a lot of problems, start having a lot of security issues. Like I see a world in which just, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I think I do know what I'm trying to say. I don't know how to say it, but what I am saying is that companies are fighting each other to ship as fast as possible. And anybody who's willing to undercut the other person and skip like due diligence and doing things correctly might actually win up front. I'm just saying, obviously, like on the back end, it's really the users that would, or the customers that would suffer. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, does that risk seem like, does that resonate with you at all? I mean,
it does, because we're like, we've sped up software engineering significantly, right? Just the amount of code that's being generated. You know that every large organization, including those that are releasing these frontier models, are using those models to create more and more software. And the guardrails are so immature that we've built around them and around these systems. And the traditional way of doing AppSec, as we've done it in the past, is just too slow to keep up with the amount of code that's being generated. And so these sorts of gaps are going to happen. If Google is struggling with it, you can only imagine how the little startup is just ignoring all of these indicators, or has not actually put guardrails and prompts in places, or is utilizing PR, you know, code review tools or whatever else, because they have to get out the door so quickly. I know, like, you know, we're talking about this from a feature request perspective as well, like your platform, like what we're doing internally, like how we're trying to optimize our own flows. It is very difficult to keep your hands on all of the changes that are going out the door. So multiply that by Google's whatever 10, 20,000 developers and the amount of code that's being shipped on an hourly, you know, minute by minute basis that's there. You've got to find some way to protect yourself, I guess, is where I'm going with that, right? Like, the risk is huge, but you've got to find a way to protect yourself, not only from your own internal product having these sorts of flaws, but also those sorts of flaws being introduced by third parties that you're dependent upon. And I think that's the gap that we haven't necessarily addressed or even thought about up to this point. Yes, you've got people that are going out and scanning, you know, OpenClaw skills, for example, looking for malicious skills or looking for flaws. And that's one thing, that's a supply chain problem. But what do you do about the supply chain that is Google, that is OpenAI, that is Claude, that is, take your pick of these like large software providers that we're depending upon that are now releasing features more quickly than we can even digest them as software engineering consumers. And I mean, I feel like there's going to be some backlash. There's going to be some compliance checks. There's going to be some additional breaches that are occurring because of this speed of software that we're just not prepared for. It's a traditional AppSec problem, and we've just compounded the risks that are associated with it.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not like that's just yesterday. I'm not kidding. It's so annoying. So I had a query I was trying to optimize, and we had like it was a SQL query, and we have this explainer function, which actually gives a really deep dive into how long a query actually takes and why it takes, like what it's doing, why it's taking the time it's taking. I asked Claude to refactor it with Opus 4.5, I believe, not 4.6, because 4.6 isn't working as well. I've said this, I think, the last two or three podcasts. So was using Opus 4.5, just vanilla SQL injection on the refactor of on this PR. I was like, I'm serious, like, I keep seeing it. It's so annoying. I'm like, why do I keep seeing stupid, like, I actually really expected to see more complex things, right? Like, a lot of like more nuanced flaws. And of course we do see that, but like, my God, the level of dumb stuff, I keep saying it, but it's really actually getting under my skin. I'm like, you shouldn't be writing SQL injection. You shouldn't be writing command injection. The whole idea of these things were to get rid of the dumb stuff. And it just keeps doing the dumb stuff over and over again. And I'm like really actually annoyed by it and frustrated. I hope they actually fix this. It's kind of a problem. I don't know if, like, to be fair, I mostly work with Anthropic models, and I use Codex and OpenAI models for review when I'm coding. So I use Codex as the reviewer and a skill, and then Claude is the thing to write the code. So I don't know. Maybe Codex would be a little smarter. Have you seen this too? Like, has this been something you've experienced, or no? You're pretty decent all around.
It's been pretty decent all around. That being said, right, like we have had issues, right? Like, you know, just helping build a site that's, you know, taking in markdown. This is a simple example, right? Like, so taking in markdown of results of various findings or whatever it is, and then getting pop-ups in the site because it just didn't protect. It didn't like include DOM purify. So all of a sudden we have cross-site scripting in our own product that's identifying cross-site scripting. You know what I mean? Like, stuff like that is definitely occurring. Always add drop commands and SQLi tests. Yeah. So things like that, right? Like, we had to like filter out all of this So I mean, basically, we have to be, you have to be so careful about how you are and what you're instructing the LLM to do, because it will go out and include dangerous commands, right, in command injection. It will include, you know, non-reversible commands for SQL injection, for cross-site scripting. It'll go and crawl a site and click on delete everywhere. You know what I mean? Like, if you're trying to be at least like walk that line that we walk as testers and not be too overtly destructive, it has no idea, right? Like it just blows right past that because you've told it that it can go out and interact with a website, right? And so I'm with you there, right? Like it is definitely, it's a scalpel, right? And it's a hammer that can do damage if you're not careful about what you've instructed it to do.
To say the least.
Which is what, good luck, Google. I mean, but when we start talking about the other like skills and tools that are available to us, right? Like that's one of the reasons why I haven't pushed too hard on like OpenClaw, right? This ability to just give it access to whatever it wants to do. And right, like the agent can be long running, which I see the advantages of. Right. Like, hey, go do this overnight and come back. And I'm, you know, it's solved the X, Y, and Z problem in the morning. But without that interaction and that oversight, the chances that it goes off the rails just get higher and higher over time. And again, like I was having this discussion with my son, right, who's, you know, same age as yours, 13, 14, right? This morning we were talking about how everything goes back to math, right? Especially in the AI world and the token prediction that's going on, it all goes back to math. And yes, like it'll follow certain avenues, but the second that it decides that this creative path is acceptable, starts to go down that creative path. And I'm talking specific agents, OpenClaw, and even like the instructive agents, right? Like where you've got a managing agent that has clients. But the second that one of those goes off the rails and starts to provide results and that reasoning drift happens, the more likely it is to occur. And mathematically, you could see the prediction and the result set that becomes wider and wider and wider the longer you let those agents run. That's why I try to scope things down, right? To be honest, right? It's why in the past, so if we go pre-AI era, there's a reason why Agile requires daily stand-ups, right? And I'm trying to personify like this threat that's in my head. But if we have a long running project, a large project that we're trying to accomplish specific tasks on, we recenter ourselves and we recenter our development teams in Agile daily. But even in Waterfall, we're doing that on a periodic basis where we have check-ins to make sure that we are not including reasoning drift in, or we're not going down side paths, we're on side quests, we're not going down rabbit holes that were unexpected. So we do this with people and we're used to doing it with people. But the decisioning that's happening with agents and with AI is so much quicker that the reasoning drift can happen in a lot, in a more severe manner in a shorter amount of time. I don't know if that's something that you've seen, but this is what I kind of go back to from a math perspective as I'm starting to think about the possible, you know, the possible data set, the possible outcomes when I'm dealing with an agent. I don't have a tendency to, with Claude Code, like my own like use of Claude Code, I have a tendency to approve a lot of things rather than just giving it carte blanche access to go out and do X, Y, and Z, because I feel like it needs that direction.
Yeah, I definitely both watch it and approve. I didn't used to watch it as well. I started off watching it really closely, and then for a little while I wasn't watching as closely, and then I realized, oh, that was a bad idea. Like, watch it more closely. And but never was I ever okay with it just arbitrarily running commands, you know, which I do have an article about that whole thing. In fact, to the point where I wouldn't let my agent make system commands. I think I talked to you about this, where I put all the call graph stuff back when I thought call graphs were useful. Turns out not as much with agents. There's different methods that are better. Anyways, I shoved the whole call graph in with JSON in a JSON using the Redis JSON module and put that into JSON and had it make queries to JSON. It would have been actually much easier and more efficient and better in all ways, except for security, to allow the agent to then like just run a straight up grep command on the, because you can save the call graphs to a JSON file. If you're using TreeSitter, it's super easy. And then you can run grep on that, right? But I'm not going to give it system commands. Like that's absolutely insane. I will say this though, the conversation I had with Andrew Wilson maybe a week or two ago about agents and especially long running agents, I think it was a question of, well, how do you keep them on track, right? Like, what if they start to deviate and do other things, which they absolutely do. And I was telling him one of the, like, and I think he already knew this, but I was sharing, you know, one common tip is like, you know, every few steps, actually having it check in, review the steps it's already taken, the steps it wants to take next. And then it's the original instructions for what it was supposed to do, like what was the original task it was supposed to be performing. And then am I actually are the actions I'm taking in line with that directive? That's the word I'm looking for, directive. You know, and if not, get yourself back on track, self-evaluate, how to do that, or otherwise proceed on. And like I said, every few steps, every so often it checks back in. And you kind of have to do that. It's like a very common way to manage long-running agentic orchestration. Speaking of which, today and tomorrow is Unprompted Con in San Francisco. I know you and I both kind of opted, ironically, because we're building the. I mean, for me, anyways. I think it was the same for you. I'm heads down building these systems. I can't really afford to go there right now, time-wise, and talk about stuff. I mean, I'd love to in the future when I have more time, but. I'm sure it's going to be awesome. I'm sure there's going to be great recordings that come out of it. What's your take on Unprompted Con? Did you see any talks or any speakers or anything that's like really, you know, you're kind of got FOMO about, even though we both kind of just chose to not go?
I mean, definitely some of the higher level discussions that they're having, right? I'm interested in, right? You know, like seeing how some practitioners or some managers are actually trying to figure out this risk and then inject it into their process. Cause it's a lot, I mean, it's in San Francisco, Silicon Valley. So you got a lot of the major players that are down there that are speaking about how like they're approaching AI. And those are the kinds of things that get to be very interesting. Just to see like when you have the resources available, what you can actually do with anything, right? Like, I mean, for years we've talked about Paved Path that came out of Netflix and how they approached AppSec, which was just such a great way to go about it, or Security Champions programs. The one thing that I like always like to caveat is that most organizations don't have that level of investment or those number of resources to throw at these problems. And so it's trying to distill that down for the startup. It's trying to distill that down for the mid-size manufacturer that, you know, has developers but has very, very little budget or appetite for this sort of safety risk. It's a harder thing to actually like dig into. So it does feel a little bit like there's a lot of, you know, large organizations that are going to be talking about interesting problems that they're running into and how they're trying to solve for it. But from a day-to-day perspective, I don't know how actually useful it's going to be, at least in the weeds where I'm at right now. What about you? What did you find? What are you missing out on? Huh?
Nothing, because my co-founders, James Wickett's there. So he's actually attending the talks for a little bit today and tomorrow, I think, amongst other meetings he's having. So I get the rundown from him. And again, Andrew Wilson will be there. So, you know, we should have Andrew on at some time. Like, he's doing offensive AI R&D over at, I believe, Bug Crowd. So, yeah, definitely between his unprompted con experience and the research he's been doing, I'd love to get him on again to kind of talk about some of this stuff. But yeah, you know, James will go, he'll listen to people talk and I had originally planned to go out there, like I said, and then last week I'm like, you know, I'm just so freaking busy. Like, we're building feature after feature after feature after feature. I mean, we are just like hammering the product right now with, you know, basically all this substrate intelligence. We're just now connecting all the dots, like all the stuff that we've ever talked about, you know, being able to log into the dashboard, open up this chat and say, tell me all my applications that Mint JWTs that are built on no Next.js that, you know, are external facing only and have PHI in them and get a list back and things like that. So it's just like, I don't know, man, when you're just knee deep in the middle of building, it's hard to take a step back and be like, okay, let me go listen to people talk. And some of those talks are probably very useful. And I'm certain some of those talks are about how they use skills and stuff. So it's, you know, it's going to be a mix like any conference. So it's kind of like I just had to make kind of a business decision, I think, on that. Mm-hmm. I will regret it is what I'm saying. And I'm sure there's like really good stuff that comes out of it. But for now, Gotta build.
Yeah.
It's kind of a life. So,
well, I mean, that's, yeah. Yeah. Well, I did want to pull up this other, man, this time always goes by so quickly, Ken. I did want to bring up this other article that I think you sent it across, the one about Perplexity's AI Comet browser, right?
Yeah.
And it's almost like, yeah, I think we talked about this, right? Like, I giving a browser and an agent access to all of your local system, right? Might just be a bad idea, right? Like, I just might, right? But they found a zero-click exploit in the AI browser. And again, this is going to depend on what you've given the browser access to, right? But we've increased the attack surface of, and if I can get all this down, man, but ads, and more ads, guys. That's what we're looking at here. zero-click. Yeah. More ads in Comet browser. And once you have access to that, the AI browser has access to more things than your traditional browser does. Right? So yeah, I guess let me see if the zero click. So zero agent. So even if you browse to a site and you don't click on anything, as long as it's got access and it recognizes that you are using the Comet browser, you can look for documents, yeah, named passwords, right? Like, it's got file access. We increase the attack surface.
The way it actually works is you submit an invitation to somebody and they accept that invitation and the calendar invite goes in their calendar. Later, when that gets summarized and that calendar invite gets summarized by AI, the prompt that was placed into the calendar invite actually gets executed and then looks for and exfiltrates all your secrets. So from like documents and things like that. So like Google Docs or whatever. So why did I post this or want to bring this up? Stop doing security things, AI companies. Like, you're not good at it. Stop. Like, you keep trying to cover these things just to make money. And it's like, not good. Stop. That's my message. If you're an AI company and you're thinking, hey, I should really get into this security game, even though that's not my specialty. Well, I have guidance for you. Stop.
Don't. It's not cool. Well, this is, yeah.
You're not good at this stuff. Stop it. Anyways, that's my message.
Well, I mean, on the flip side, do you want to talk about security companies that decide they're developers all of a sudden, right? Like, you know, because we have that same problem of, hey, I'm able to write a script that detects this one exploit or does X, Y, and Z. We're full on developers now, right? Like, you know, we're going to create a dashboard. And now with Claude Code, it's even worse, right? Like, we're going to have a SaaS product. That, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've seen a lot of that. I've seen a lot of people building their own stuff. I mean, I think, you know, like you and I talked about, it's kind of going to be the way that things go, I think. And on that note, it's, you know, I brought this up to you privately, but I guess since we're talking about it, I'll say it out loud. It's like, well, one of the main things that we've always said, especially like a lot of us have worked in security consultancies, whenever we work in those, there's always this desire to build our own tooling, usually because the tooling that like is out there isn't quite what we need. Maybe it's missing some things. Maybe it's just really expensive. Like I remember times where, you know, it would have been really nice to have a Fortify or something like that. And I mean, that was obviously 15, 16, 17 years ago, but it would have been really nice. And sometimes I don't even have those tools available because of the cost. And so I get the desire to build tooling, but we never really could, right? And if we built tooling, it would just be for us. And it wasn't something we could really like. Basically the rule was services can't, especially bootstrap service company, can't also build product. That was just the rule. And now that's not the rule anymore. The rule is nothing. There's no rule. Like if you have an AI assisted editor, and some level of knowledge about how to build things, or maybe even not, you can build something. You can get something off the ground. So I do think, yeah, well, you're right. We'll see a plethora of formerly services-focused people building tools. Yeah. But I just want to say, the thing that really annoys me, seriously, is browsers are really, really hard. And I'm not saying that AI companies shouldn't have some level of, like, Google Chrome, for instance, it has this ability in the developer tools to summarize some of what it sees from like your network tab and your console and things like that, right? So that's pretty nice. It's a nice little troubleshooting thing. I can't speak to the security of it, but you know, it's kind of like taking and putting a piece of something that's useful into something that's been hardened and worked on for years and years and years. And every time company comes out, whether it's a security company or an AI company or whoever, to build their version of a browser, I don't think I've ever seen it end well. Have you?
No. Nope. I have not, right? Like because of those exact facts, right? Is that they try to accomplish some bespoke task or some problem that they see with the wider, like the larger platforms. And while they usually accomplish that task, they don't always take into account everything else that goes into building a large browser platform or a platform to actually browse the web. And so they're always playing catch up to what is coming out of Firefox, what is coming out of, you know, WebKit, right? Like what's coming out of Chrome, and meeting that level of expectation from a consumer perspective is incredibly difficult. And so you end up taking shortcuts. And what happens when you take shortcuts? Things like this with Comet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why anyone's surprised. It totally makes sense. You know, it's just, they're supposed to listen to you. And if you don't do, and again, like, I don't mean to poo-poo on, I get it. It's hard. And I get like, it's probably an avenue. I'm probably the idiot here. Right? Honestly, this is probably the right thing to do in long-term, blah, 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 blah. I don't know, man. I get sick of like, yeah, the browsers specifically. Browsers bother me because they're just so freaking hard to do right. And yeah, that's like, what else can I say? It's not something you should enter into as like a side project and not your main thing. I guess that's what I really mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and I think in general, that's probably a good rule of thumb for companies, right? Like with the new AI agents that are available, it becomes very tempting to step into additional revenue streams, right? Mm. Because you can see the value of it that's there. But when it's not your expertise, it usually means that you don't have the experience not to make the mistakes or to give even the AI agents the correct guardrails to prevent breaches, to prevent things from happening. Like, I mean, we saw this initially as people were using Codex and they're building an application and deploying it to AWS, and all of a sudden their AWS keys are out in the wild in the mobile application that they just created, because that was the easiest way to make it work, because they had no idea underneath the hood what should actually go into developing an application. Now, some of that's been protected nowadays with, you know, Claude and the AI agents that have at least like some level of guardrails, but it still will do things like that and go off the rails, like you're seeing with Opus 4.6, and create insecure applications because it's trying to accomplish the overall task that it was given as quickly as possible and as efficiently as possible. And what is security? It's not a feature. It's a side quest. It is a cost center. And it's going to continue to be a cost center. So anyway, like, I mean, I feel like it's same as it ever was, shall I say?
I don't know. It's just quicker. I don't know if it is, though. Because I'm seeing like a lot of budget issues right now for security. And I wonder if that's not because of, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what that's because of. I actually can't even make any assumptions. You know, there's a lot that's changing in the economy right now. I get that. A lot of ups and downs in a lot of areas. But one thing that, like, I will say is, like, it does feel a little different lately. I see a lot more churn in personnel, and I see a lot of budgets sort of falling out recently. And that's a little concern. I guess what I'm saying that is, like, I don't know why that is, for one, but it seems to not just be affecting security, you know? So yeah, I don't know. I'm seeing workforce reductions, seeing a lot of budgets get pulled back in the security community.
Well, I mean, should we talk about Block, right? Like, I know that wasn't necessarily on our agenda for the day, but the fact that
what happened
to Jack Dorsey at Blocks, right? Basically laid off 4,000 of their workforce, 40% of its workforce.
What?
This happened this last week. Yeah. All because they're doing like an AI shift across the board, right? Like AI native tools everywhere. And that was 4 days ago, right? Here's the Wall Street Journal article. Crap. I'm going to delete that one. I had too much stuff in it. Yeah.
There's a bit of this, like, I have to say, the whole like Silicon Valley thing, it is a little strange. It's just a little strange. Like they're, I mean, it's always been strange, but I feel like that whole sector is just getting stranger and stranger and stranger. So let's see. Okay. Let's see. Man who does peyote in desert and looks like a hippie is cutting 4,000 jobs for suspicions of AI washing. Okay, cool. Yeah, sounds cool. Man, my God. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, I wonder, I don't know. I'm just not loving seeing the shift in the rapid shift in everything, from the economy to the technology to the processes to the everything. It's a lot of churn and whiplash. I don't know if every practitioner, especially the community, they'd have to respond. The community, our community would have to respond in like Slack or YouTube comments. But I don't know if like the difference between most people and Seth and I feel, and this could be wrong, but I feel like with Seth, he's talking to a lot of different organizations about application security. I also talk to a lot of organizations about their application security, but I work with organizations to build the things that are like bleeding edge to get ahead of these types of things with their teams. So I feel like the two of us have a little bit of a unique perspective, because we're talking to, first of all, a more diverse group than most, I think, but also more frequently. And also for me specifically, and I believe it's the same for you, I know you've done a ton of work with AI and Web3 companies. You know, we're just sort of like working with some of the bleeding edge. And I don't know if this whiplash and this churn is felt by others in the community, or if this is just a, well, no, if you're like, yeah, I don't know, if you're, if those are your kinds of clients, then yes, you'll see that. But otherwise, it's pretty normal elsewhere. Or if everybody, like, meaning, I don't know if the, like, let's say an enterprise is feeling this right now, right? I mean, are they, I'd assume they, a lot of those are slow moving and still sort of doing things the old way still. So I just don't know where it's hard. I guess I don't have like a good barometer anymore for where are the things at, other than this, like, you know, specific group, although it does vary between small to very large orgs. It's usually my buyers are people that are, you know, obviously like
cutting edge. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Not the old ways.
Well, and I mean, some of the response to Block here has been that this is more AI washing, right? Like, yes, they're saying it's because, you know, they're switching to AI, but it's almost, they're using AI as an excuse to do a larger cut across the board. So, you know, you kind of have to take that with a grain of salt. To your larger question, what I'm seeing, and, you know, servicing companies across all of these various industries, and this is part of what gives me actual, you know, hope that we're not necessarily falling too far behind, is that there's the bleeding edge, which is what you and I like to talk about, which is what we're dealing with. And especially on your side, like people that are looking at generative AI, that are looking at AI first and AI native solutions, are that bleeding edge right now. I have companies that have no idea what is going on in that space. And if anything, they're only entering the chatbot era of AI and generative AI, that they just barely put a chatbot out to help with customer support. And like, how long have chatbots been around, right? Like, you know, we're talking there 3+ years almost behind. And then that, nothing to say about like the different heavily regulated industries where, you know, whether that be government, whether that be financial, or healthcare, that they are very, very cautious about introducing something so innovative and so creative without guardrails into those environments and into that data. It does happen on some level, but it is very much behind the curve, right? That those sorts of changes happen. So like, that is what gives me hope that, you know, hey, we're going to be able to build something that we're help, that will help us out now to be kind of first to market or whatever it is, but also help that long tail of, hey, I have customers that haven't dipped their toe into generative AI yet. And maybe we can be the impetus for that to show them how effective it is to utilize these sorts of tools so that we become, again, stickier as a services organization, and we can help them secure their platform and all the, you know, traditional AppSec SDLC things. Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
I really have a comment. So, I just agree, yeah. I guess. I don't really have any input to add. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting to watch, right? And it's hard. I know, like, I was talking to, you know, I was texting back and forth with Sean Porras about like our last episode, and he mentioned,
hey, wait, when were you texting with him? Hold on.
Just a couple days ago. It was probably about the same time.
It was the same. You. Okay. All right. Good to know. He's also texting me. Okay.
He just needs to include us in a group chat, because that would probably be better. But I know that's his fear, as like, he's working internal to an organization as kind of like an AppSec service for a large organization, like an internal. And are we doing this properly, right? Like, are we actually like utilizing these tools to effectively identify vulnerabilities and secure an organization, secure an application? And like, because I do feel like I'm slow at it, right? Like, and I know we're not, like, I know we're dealing with cutting edge topics, but it's hard not to feel behind the eight ball when you're not the one that identified the latest, you know, technique or the latest, you know, prompt evaluation framework or whatever it is that makes you that much more effective. I don't know. I don't have a lot else to say there.
That's just the thing that people focus on their vulnerabilities, but it's like, that's not even, it's just one part of the picture, you know? And I mean, that was like, I guess, harkening back to when Anthropic did their release, and then, you know, everybody had a response, including myself and all of that. And it's like, well, you still need other stuff. Yeah. Like, it doesn't just get rid of AppSec. It doesn't kill, because that was the thing. It was like, oh, does this kill AppSec? How could it kill AppSec? There's like a million things we do. And I wish that we didn't have to do sometimes, but we do. We do have to do. And so it's not just vulnerability management, right? One thing that I think a lot of people are starting to lean into are automating their design reviews, right? Just so that they, like, here's what you said you were going to build. What's our security kind of quick synopsis of that? And then, you know, did you actually align to the things that we said, right? Just literally making sure specs align with the security standards you set forth during a security review, or even automating. And I don't mean like doing an actual review of code for vulnerabilities. I mean, an actual security review of how is the system designed? What is it connecting to? You know, what kind of data is being processed? Have you categorized things correctly? Are you logging correctly? Whatever design, and, you know, usually you have conversations where you have to talk through these design considerations. So I am seeing people more and more kind of leaning into automating those things. I think those are an easier thing to automate than finding vulnerabilities. And I think they're really incredibly important right now, specifically because of the speed at which people are just shipping. So things are always being, and actually I think what's really nice is, what would really be nice is some single pane of glass to kind of connect dots a bit better, meaning like when you can throw, let's say you can get through a couple PRs in a day, like you could write a couple pull requests in a day, right? Now you can do 30. You kind of said something this earlier in the podcast that triggered this thought, which was, man, it'd be nice to have a single pane of glass to see who's all working on what, right? Because what I'm finding is at the speed that we're going, like someone will be working on something that's connected to something I'm doing and vice versa. And it gets hard to even know that those things, and this isn't even a secure, I mean, it's very much in line with security problem, but it's not, you know, specific to only security, just not knowing what everybody's working on. It's not a security thing. It's an engineering thing. It's like, well, everybody's shipping everything now, and you can work on one PR while your other PR is working. And you might be like, well, I know this other feature is going to be built, so I'll do some of the back end plumbing or whatever for this thing that's going to, and then the next thing you know, you've got like, okay, well, it used to be a bit easier with sprints because you were talking about agile and you're talking about standups and how we like kind of talk about what we're all building. Problem is, we're all building 15 different things, and we may even be writing, I've seen now issues and pull requests that overlap, and we're trying to like make sure we don't have that, but it's just when everybody can go really, really fast, it's kind of the nature of things. So I think well, let me bring it all back. I think where I'm going with it is, I just feel like our job, if I'm watching where the bleeding edge is going and what's changing, I think vulnerabilities will be like just kind of, sort of something an automated system kind of helps you with, like finding and resolving. And I think more so, it's like a lot of oversight, governance, and structural sort of observability more than it is, you know, vulnerability. Like I talked about that feature, the whole goal is to get to a world in which AppSec really should is like, for the most part, pretty hands-off on vuln level stuff, right? Like you tell me about a vuln, your automated system tells me about a vuln. I talk to it. If I don't disagree, or if I disagree, or if I don't understand, helps me get to resolution. I don't have to talk to a security person. Yeah, maybe there's an exit hatch, but the point is that most of the time I should not have to talk to a security person. And then the security person should more have, in my opinion, more oversight as to what all activities are going on, for everything from, you know, features being shipped to like weird, odd behaviors and outliers and patterns and things of that nature. So sorry, that's a long rant. My part this time, but I think you know where I'm going with that. I don't think vulnerability.
I do.
That we should care about.
No, it's not. It's not, right? Because it's the whole SDLC. And one of the deficiencies that I'm seeing over and over is this, is the way that we have approached security in general in the past, which has been very vulnerability focused, right? We have built tools based on vulnerabilities, not necessarily on full coverage. And like, I could go off on this. Like, I know we're close to wrapping up the podcast today. But it's one of my pet peeves that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about is how we have structured security tools to be based on patterns, bad patterns, and not necessarily on what is the full picture of things that we should be looking at. We're trying to back our way into that, but the core engine at most of the tools that we've developed over the years, especially deterministic tools, has been what is bad, and that's the high signal that we're looking for, not necessarily am I looking at a complete application. So even from a dynamic perspective, we have huge gaps in our coverage of what we're actually assessing or what we're actually testing. And same thing from a code perspective. Like, we're looking very closely at like X, Y, and Z, but that means that we aren't necessarily exposing the gaps in that coverage because we never take into account the wider aspect of everything that is actually in the code. AI is giving us that ability now, but I still think it requires a shift in our thinking as AppSec practitioners, how we approach these singular activities that have been so vulnerability focused over the years. Yeah. There's going to be more to come.
On just that. There's going to be, I don't know, man, like the future is bright and interesting and scary all at the same time.
Yeah.
That's yep. probably the gist of it. trying to guess where it's going is a fun one.
Yeah. Fun one. Yeah, let's go with that. It is a fun one. So
let me add one last thing to that. Speaking of fun.
Okay.
Here's a new one. I'll save this for another day. We've been going for a while. I mean, over an hour. Yeah.
Yes. Well, we appreciate everyone. Thanks again for listening and for joining in. Jump into Slack. Let us know what your thoughts are on where the industry's going, right? If you are seeing anything like that Comet attack, I'd love to hear it, especially your experiences with OpenClaw and other things. Like, I want to continue that conversation because it is something that we're exploring more and more. Jump into Slack. Hit me up on LinkedIn, whatever it is. Love to have further conversations there. And otherwise, come to training at KernelCon or at DEF CON Singapore. And yeah, we will chat besides that. So appreciate everyone. We'll see y'all next week.
Thank you.